gentlemen, to 65 Principles for a Successful Trial. In this lecture, you are going to learn how to become a winning trial lawyer. My name is Bernie Brown. I recently retired as an assistant city attorney for the Los Angeles City Attorney's Office after serving 29 years. During those 29 years, I spent 25 years as a supervising attorney. As a supervising attorney, I supervised hundreds of lawyers in trial. That is, I coached them and advised them on trial strategies. I observed them in trial, and then I observed the results of their trial. I also did my own trial, and I had 90% overall trial conviction rate. I did dozens of trials, and I've supervised the lawyers, coached them in hundreds of trials. And frequently, the lawyers I supervised had a 100% conviction rate. So, having said that, oh, by the way, I also served as an internal MCLA presenter for the LA City Attorney's Office on several occasions. So, having said that, let's get down to the matter. Now, first, I'm going to briefly talk to you about, and this is the only kind of like psychological, metaphysical part of this program, but I'm going to talk to you about a winning attitude. There are some lawyers who have a winning attitude. Now, if you follow the techniques that you will learn in this lecture, you will develop a winning attitude. A winning attitude is an attitude where you get in a mindset where you know you will win. You know that you are a winner, and you get to a point where no matter what is thrown at you, you know that you can win. I've been there. I know it exists. In sports, it's called being in the zone. And in the same thing applies with regard to trial lawyers. There are some lawyers I noticed that were just winners. They're like a mouse in a maze. They could always figure out the maze and always figure out how to get out of the maze. And when it comes to trials, they could always figure out how to win a trial. They were in the zone, the winning zone. And if you follow all of the techniques in this lecture, you will enter the zone, the winning zone. Well, now, so let's get started with the substance. Where it starts is meticulously screening everything that you have in your case. And that means going for the fine details. I cannot tell you how many times one little fact in a report, one little statement in a witness statement, one little sentence can make the entire difference in your case as to whether you're a winner or a loser. So, what must you do immediately when you get your case? Screen all the facts, all of the reports, all of the witness statements, go through them meticulously with absolute learning and remembering all of the fine details. What time the sun set, what time the sun went up, the time on the video, and all of these particular facts can make a difference or will make a difference in winning your case. And another thing that you must do is you've got to step back and you've got to analyze all of the information and evidence you have impartially. You cannot or should not bring in your own biases into your case. Yes, you have to have a clear understanding of human nature because that's what wins cases. But you must step back and look at it from the view of a juror. How would they accept the evidence? And using that approach, determine the strengths and the weaknesses in your case. Now, I must say, I generally advise, if you can, do not go to trial on a weak case. Certainly, there are some cases that you need to go to trial on. As a prosecutor, if you're a prosecutor, you have an ethical responsibility not to proceed to trial on a case where there's no reasonable probability that the trial will result in a conviction. But When I say don't go to trial on a weak case, yes, analyze the case. If it's not a winner, then try to settle it. If it's a civil case, then try to obviously settle it. If it's a criminal case, work out some kind of plea bargain if possible. But having said that, don't run away from the weak cases. You will get your strongest, greatest reputation as being a great trial lawyer when you can take the tough cases to trial and win them. You do not want to get a reputation of being a lawyer that's afraid of the tough cases. So it's a balancing act in your evaluation. Now, the next part, the next point I'm going to make is so very important, and so many lawyers don't do it. And it amazes me that they don't. Step number one, or step number two, should we say, is when you get a trial, go look at the jury instructions. Actually, you should, when you first, and when I say get a trial, when you first get the case, go start looking at the jury instructions. The jury instructions tell you what the law is on the case and what you must prove. It tells you the elements of the case that you must prove. That means you have to start analyzing and you have to start determining. You must determine what facts that you will need to bring into evidence in order to satisfy every element of the case. So you have to go look immediately at the CalCrims or the, in the case of a civil case, the KC. This is in for California jury instructions, and analyze them and consider all possible defenses. That when you're analyzing the jury instructions, also analyze and study any and all possible laws that relate to your case, any and all possible defenses, any exemptions, and do this with an understanding that you're doing it to understand what you must prove in the case. Because at some point, the judge is going to read those jury instructions to the jurors. And is going to say, this is what must be proven, and whether it's a defense or whether it's in the affirmative case. So this sets your guideline for how you should proceed. Now, thoroughly, 100% prepare for trial. Johnny Cochran used to say, preparation, preparation, preparation. That was his big what he would say over and over and over during lectures, whenever he would give presentations. And what that means is what we said earlier. It means interviewing your witnesses and going through all the documents and everything and preparing for trial, meticulously preparing for trial. You're going to be sending out your investigators to interview witnesses. But at some point, you've got to conduct your own interviews. That is, you've got to sit down with that witness, and you've got to have the witness statements before you, and you must look that witness in the eye and see how that witness is going to come across. You've got to assess the witness, assess the witness's credibility, assess the witness's honesty, assess the witness's persuasiveness. Ultimately, it's generally witnesses that will make or break your case, and so I highly, absolutely recommend that at some point you personally interview all of your witnesses. Now, you've got to prepare 24 hours a day, and that sounds crazy, but when you're preparing for trial, you must keep a notepad nearby, or if it's not a notepad, you need to keep your tape recorder nearby, because what happens, every trial lawyer, great lawyer, trial lawyer I know says what happens is 4 o'clock in the morning, they wake up and their mind, their subconscious has been working on the case all night, and their mind is just flowing with suggestions and ideas and things to do and arguments to make, or they're on the freeway or they're driving home and these ideas are coming to them. You want to get them, write them all down as soon as they come to your mind, so that you don't forget them, because you might forget a critical argument that you need to make in your case. Now, ultimately, you need to create a checklist. Now, the checklist, obviously, is a list of everything you must do in the case and everything you must prove in the case. And that means it could be your checklist should be or could be like go interview witness, go to the location, review the videotape, check out the timeline on the internet with regard to the time that the sun set. I mean, all of these, everything that must be done, prepare charts or whatever, everything that must be done should be listed on your checklist. And you just check it off as it gets done. You want to do this to make sure that you don't forget anything that should be done. Now, you should investigate all leads and claims thoroughly. You know, you've seen that Columbo, that television series, or Matlock, and these lawyers are out there. Matlock is actually a lawyer in the case, I mean in the television series. And he goes out and he's talking to witnesses and he's checking out the case and trying to figure out what's going on. I can tell you that actually works. You got to investigate all leads. I'll give you some examples, just a couple of quick examples. There was a time when we had a case, we had a vehicular manslaughter case, and the issue was what time the defendant took the stand, or the witness statements stated that there were shadows. I'm sorry, not shadows, that there was he was blinded by the sun. And that's why he ran over this lady in the crosswalk. So what did we do? We went out and went from shopkeeper to shopkeeper, and we found the video. And on the video, we were able to find the exact time that the collision occurred. Now, admittedly, we could not find video of that particular accident or collision, but we could find the location and the exact time that was depicted. And what did you see in there? A shadow over the location where the defendant made contact with the victim. So it's that doing that little extra. It's going following on all possible leads that makes the difference in whether you will win a case or whether you lose a case. Now, I also suggest that you discuss the case with your colleagues. You do not have a monopoly on all possible arguments that can be made and all possible ideas. So discuss the case, bounce it off their minds, get their ideas, but do the same thing with regard to your friends. Obviously, you don't want to violate the attorney-client privilege, but you do need the insight. Keep in mind that the jurors are made up of common folk. And guess what? Many of your friends or neighbors are common folk. So you want to bounce the case off of them and talk to them about, let's for this facts, give them facts and ask them what they think about the facts and what they would think they would need to prove the case, or what would make them feel more comfortable in coming back with a verdict that's consistent with your argument. And then redirect your approach in trial to address any concerns or issues that they may bring up. My daughter is a deputy district attorney, and my wife's a judge. Before she was a judge, we would all get together sometimes and discuss our cases and talk about the facts. I still talk with my daughter occasionally about, we discuss trial strategies, and she frequently says, oh, you came up with something I hadn't thought of, and some of the people in her office come up with ideas. So the important point from this is to discuss the case and get a pool of ideas and assess them and analyze them. Also, watch great attorneys in trial. When I was a young I wasn't a lawyer at the time, I was in law school, I had the opportunity to go watch Melvin Belli. Wow. He was an attorney at the time, attorney for, he represented a lot of celebrities, multi-rich torts lawyer. And this guy was amazing. I learned so much. You will learn so much from watching great lawyers in trial, you take your notepad with you and write down everything, any ideas that come to you, any observations that you find are very impressive. I found that Melvin Belli was totally in command and control of the total of the entire courtroom. Hard to believe, huh? I could give you some examples. I'm running out of time, but quickly, he had such a command of the law that the judge, whenever there were objections or rulings, the judge wouldn't rule against him, or he would kindly say, withdraw the question, Your Honor, and then he would rephrase the question so that it would be even more piercing. But the bottom line is, go watch the best. Learn from great trial lawyers. Always visit the scene. Always go and look at the scene where the incident occurred. This gives you a feeling that you cannot get from just reading papers and documents. If you go there and you walk it and you see where the trees are and where everything is located, it makes a big difference. I had a case once where the defendant testified that it was dark at the location where it occurred, where the crime occurred. Now, I had been to the scene, so I knew exactly what it looked like. So I got him, I pinpointed him. Well, sir, was it in front of this house? Was it at this particular location? And he said, yes. Oh, yes, sir, that's where it was at. During the lunch hour, I raced over to the location, took a picture, and came back and showed it to him. I said, is this the location? Yes, this is the location. And this is the house, is right in front of this house? Yes. And what do you see right there in the middle of the picture? Oh, well, that's a lamppost. Oh, blew away the darkness theory. Blew away their defense because you had a light lamppost right there, right over the location where it occurred. Now, here is your absolute basic ultimate goal. That is to figure out what the jurors will want to know in order to vote in your favor. You've got to look at those calcrims and figure out what evidence you must produce in order to get them to vote for you, vote for your case. Identify critical facts that must be proven to win your case, and from that, develop a winning theme. Your winning theme, you will have to use it throughout your entire case. You should present it throughout your entire case, I should say. I'll give you an example. In the O.J. Simpson case, O.J. Simpson, Johnny Cochran argued, ladies and gentlemen, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Well, you'll remember that. The glove that the murderer used was found at the scene. And he went through this big old demonstration where O.J. Simpson put the glove on, tried to put the glove on his hand and strained, and supposedly the glove did not go over his hand. So the theme in that one, and Johnny Cochran had several themes, but the theme in that one was, well, the glove didn't fit. The glove that the murderer wore did not fit. Therefore, O.J. Simpson cannot be the murderer. Now, the prosecution counterargument, obviously, shoulda, woulda, coulda been, wait a minute, ladies and gentlemen, that was the largest size that they make. It completely covered his hand all the way to his wrist. It did fit, and he put on this big demonstration, ladies and gentlemen, to try to make it look like it didn't fit, but in fact, the glove fit. So you should not acquit, you should convict. Anyway, that's one of the things. Develop a winning theme and emphasize it. I'm going to tell you later, talk to you more about how to incorporate your winning theme throughout your trial, because you're going to incorporate it during voir dire, you're going to incorporate it during direct and cross-examination, and during closing argument. We're going to talk about every aspect of the trial, but we've got so much to cover in so little time. Now, you produce all supportive witnesses and evidence. It's amazing how lawyers don't use some of their most powerful evidence. Go back to O.J. Simpson case. They had O.J. Simpson, and I'm sorry to get so excited. I'm kind of an excited person. They had O.J. Simpson in a car with weapons, driving with money too, thousands of dollars, driving toward the border, fleeing. You got to use that evidence of flight. I am always shocked when I see lawyers that frequently do not present their most powerful arguments and their most powerful evidence. Always present to your jury the most powerful evidence. You got to prepare your witnesses for trial. Now, what does that mean? That means to tell them to remain calm at all times and to tell the truth about everything. You got to sit down with them with their witness statement, show them their witness statement, and talk to them about their testimony and what their statement is and what they stated, shall I say, in their statements. I'm kind of babbling, but let's keep it going. Tell them, like I said, to remain calm and not get angry, and if the judge permits them, to explain their answers. Now you say, what's the big deal with this calmness, not getting angry? What is that all about? Well, what we used to do at the city attorney's office is we had like an exit survey after trial. And so what we would do is the lawyers would write down a trial exit statement, and they would talk include the facts of the case and how the witnesses performed and what evidence came into the case. And I, over a few summers, I had some law clerks analyze. They were actually a couple of them were statistical analyst type law clerks, and they crunched the numbers, and we found that the most frequently reoccurring reason that we for losing a case was when the jurors did not like your key witness because that key witness was angry or upset or had an attitude or wasn't believable. Usually it was because the key witness got angry on the stand and had a negative attitude. So statistically, it was borne out to be overwhelmingly the most frequently cited reason why we lost cases. So keep that in mind when you're talking to your witnesses and overemphasize it to them that that they should remain calm. Now, remember to charge all appropriate counts and defenses. I'm always shocked, too, when lawyers don't charge all the appropriate counts. And some of the counts are easy to prove, whether you're talking civil. In civil, you've got to list all possible defenses, too, and all possible theories for every count. But I'm shocked, like, take, for instance, in a criminal case, a lot of times the lawyers will charge the felony but not an easily provable misdemeanor. Or they will charge the greater charge but not the lesser charge, or a charge that may not be a lesser charge because the elements are slightly different, but they're easier to prove. I'll give you an example. A lot of lawyers will charge the grand theft, but they won't charge the being in possession of stolen property. Well, the defendant, let's say, was found in possession of thousands of dollars, worth of stolen property. And yet they don't charge the receiving stolen property, which has fewer elements and is generally much easier to prove. Doesn't make logical sense to me. In any event, always know all of the elements, like we said earlier, that you must prove to win your case. You'll get that. You'll create, like I mentioned before, create a checklist. But the checklist I was talking about earlier was like a to-do checklist. But you're going to create a checklist of all of the elements, all of the elements you must prove on one side of this checklist. Ultimately, you're going to create a chart, and it's going to have all the elements you must prove and all the facts that came in to prove each individual element of the case. Like I've said earlier, go the extra mile. Put in the extra effort. This will make the difference. I've seen it so many times where a lawyer did something extra. He went someplace extra, found some extra evidence, DNA, or went and found an extra witness by interviewing several witnesses.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is FISH. F-I-S-H. FISH. Esquire CLE's first verification code is FISH. F-I-S-H. FISH. Please take a moment and write this down.
He was able to locate an additional witness, and that additional witness was an impartial witness that made the difference in the case. The important point is to be motivated, to be on fire to win your case. If you're on fire and you're motivated to win your case, you will definitely increase the probability that you will in fact, win the case. Now, anticipate and prepare appropriate motions. There are many great lawyers that I know that believe cases are won or lost by the motions that are filed and or lost, shall we say. So if it's a civil case, you're obviously going to be making your motions in limine. You may be making motions to dismiss if it's appropriate. Criminal lawyers, you will be making it's evidence code 1101, 1108, 1109, motions that relate to the admissibility of evidence. Because as a criminal, if you're a criminal prosecutor, you're going to be trying to get in all of the evidence possible that is supportive of your case. And if you're a defense attorney, you're going to be trying to keep it out. So if it's appropriate, you're going to always be making search and seizure motions, motions to quash, and absolutely, you must make all appropriate discovery motions because you want to get as much information as you can so that you can be informed and aware of what you must defeat. You want to anticipate counterarguments, anticipate through discovery and through all of the information you have what your opponent is going to throw at you, what's going to be their most powerful argument. So you sit down and you figure out what is their strongest position, and then you must figure out how to overcome that, how to defeat that through the evidence that you are going to be coming in your case. Now, at some point, and this should be, you should create a trial notebook. You should have a notebook that you keep, that you have for all of your trials, and a notebook that is that you can alter for the particular trial that you are engaged in. And what should be in your notebook? You should have simple voir dire questions. You should have hundreds of thousands of them correlating to whatever your practice of is related to, whatever the trials are related to. You should have outlines for direct and cross-examination. And you should have canned closing arguments. Now, we're going to talk about more later about canned closing arguments. There are several canned closing arguments that you will make in virtually every case in your field of practice, shall we say. One of the ones that we make, I'll just give you a quick one. I'm going to discuss with you some more later if we can get to them. The witness, ladies and gentlemen, told you the truth even when it hurt the case. He said things, ladies and gentlemen, that actually hurt our case or hurt the case. But it proves that he, from the evidence, it proves that he's telling the truth, that he told you the truth and was not biased toward one side or the other. I mean, you will incorporate these canned arguments into every case. And we will talk more about them as we go along. I'm going to try to give you at the end a whole about several, as many as I can, canned arguments that you must make. Always portray 100% confidence in your case. Always portray 100% confidence in your case before, during, and after trial. Don't let people know that you're hurt. You act like, oh, yes, I knew that, and I'm aware of that, and always portray 100% confidence. Now, let's get a little bit into jury selection, because jury selection is very important. Here's where we go with that. Do not make ridiculous or unbelievable arguments. You must get your jurors to believe you and to trust you. If they trust you, they will vote in your favor. If they like you, they will vote in your favor. Get jurors to like you. That means during jury selection, make a joke here or there. Be personable. Be likable. It is harder for jurors to vote against you if they like you as a lawyer. And you must not make incredible, unbelievable arguments. What you should do, and I'm kind of there during jury selection. You want to get them to talking. You want to get them to speaking, to discussing what they feel about things, and you want to use hypotheticals to get them to do that. Now, one of the I invented something called the parallel hypothetical. I'm going to give you one real quickly just so you understand. A family goes to a camping trip, and while they're at the camping trip, the mother prepares a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And they get a call, and they have to leave the campsite immediately. When they come back, and when they return to the cabin, there is a bear there sitting at the table, in a chair, sitting at the table. And the bear, the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are all gone, and the bear has peanut butter and jelly on his paws and whiskers. Do you believe, ladies and gentlemen, that the bear ate the peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Now, this is a circumstantial evidence hypothetical. It's training them, it's grooming your jurors so that they understand that there may not necessarily be somebody who saw, in this particular case, a theft, but you could still prove the case even without somebody who actually saw the theft. And it's a parallel hypothetical. Obviously, you can't ask the jurors to prejudge the evidence. It would be objectionable, and the judge would sustain that objection. But if you create this parallel hypothetical, this one parallel to a theft case, by the facts of the hypothetical, you can get their feelings without even on how they will react. You get them to talking. You get them to discussing what they think and what they believe, and at the same time, you are grooming them. You must, and this is a very, 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 very important point, always look at the juror's body language. You've got to be watching them all the time, analyzing. You're looking at the little flinch of the eye, a little cut of the eye, a little twitch of the body, a little agonizing face. You're going to be doing this, watching the juror's body language throughout the entire trial. Obviously, in jury selection, you're asking open-ended questions. Do not keep a juror on your jury who disagrees with your position on the law. I'll give you an example. If you have a juror who says, "Oh, I think all drugs should be legal." Well, if you're the prosecutor, and it is a drug case, you're gonna want to kick this person. Alternatively, if the juror says, "I think all drugs should be illegal," and then if you're a defense lawyer, you may want to kick the person. In any event, use your instincts. And if the juror is saying things that you think indicate that the juror is not going to be sympathetic to your case, then yes, you do want to kick that juror. Now, keep in mind that the stereotypes about people, there's generally some degree of reliability in those stereotypes. Usually older people are more conservative. Usually younger people are more liberal and more tolerant. Your understanding of human nature, of what motivates people, is absolutely important in analyzing jurors and analyzing your case. Use it, and use it well. And if your instincts tell you that you need to kick a juror, kick that juror. If you're watching the body language during direct examination, and you've got to be watching everything in the courtroom, and if you look two over to the side to look at your jurors, and when a witness makes a certain statement, you see a juror kind of squirm or flinch as if that juror did not like the answer, then you're going to ask a follow-up question of the witness to try to correct, to try to rehabilitate the impact and effect that that statement apparently had on your juror or your jurors. So the important point from this is always keep your eyes open on everything that's going on in the entire courtroom and always be aware of body language. Now, in your opening statement, present your most powerful facts and tell the jurors, this is the most important fact. So you might say to the jury, obviously you're not supposed to argue during opening statement, but you can tell them, ladies and gentlemen, the facts or the evidence will show in this particular case, this powerful fact that the defendant was whatever he was. Now, you've already defined it as a most important, powerful fact, and then you're telling them what the evidence will show, which is totally proper, and so you're directing them, and you want to direct them toward your most powerful themes in the case, and so this is how you do it. You got to listen closely, too, to your opponent's opening statement. Because your opponent's opening statement will contain clues as to where they're going to go with their case, as to what they're going to make as their most powerful arguments. And so learning from those clues, as we discussed earlier, you will need to prepare a preemptive attack in anticipation of their case. And you will be doing that in your direct or cross-examination. If you think that it's going to be self-defense, then you're going to obviously prepare your questionings to defeat a case of self-defense. I had a situation once where I was in trial, and the defendant, it was looking to me like it was going to be self-defense, and sure enough, that's what it was. Defendant said, "Oh, by the way, the victim came at me with the bat, and he was swinging the bat at me, and I had a knife, and when he swung it at me, it was nothing left for me to do, but I came forward and I stabbed him." And I got him to show how they were face to face. And then I showed him the picture of the stab wound. And the stab wound was in the center of the victim's back. And I argued in closing argument, well, this proves that the victim's statement was true, because the victim said he was running away from the defendant. And if the defendant told you the truth, it's illogical to believe that he could have gotten that puncture wound in the center of his back. I'm going to talk about it a little later more so, but I need to hit it just a little bit right now. The most powerful persuader in any case, the most powerful persuader is logic. I'm jumping around, but I've seen lawyers in trial, and I've seen some lawyers, and I like lawyers to have passion. Passion is beautiful. It helps. But I've seen lawyers with very little passion just have a checklist and go through logical arguments that were undefeatable, shall we say, and win cases just by pure logic. The most powerful persuader in any case is logic. We'll talk more about that later. Now, prepare your outlines of areas for direct and cross-examination. Listen attentively to all witness answers. It's very, very important. I've seen so many times when lawyers don't listen, don't hear the answer. They're not listening to the answers. When you listen to the answer on direct or cross-examination, that's how you redirect your next question. And I've seen lawyers not do that. We're going to talk briefly about knowing the rules of evidence. You must absolutely, unequivocally know every rule of evidence as it relates to your practice of law. You should make appropriate objections, but do not appear to be trying to cover up anything. So make appropriate objections with regard to the rule of evidence, but don't make an objection when the testimony that's about to come in is likely to help your case. I've seen lawyers do this a dozen times where they know that the answer that's going to come in is hearsay, yes, but it's going to help their case. Well, don't object. They object because it's hearsay rather than let helpful testimony come in. Do not object to everything. Now, on cross-examination, ask leading questions. A leading question is a question that suggests the answer in the question. Keep in mind, a leading question is one where you say, isn't it true, sir, that you went to the scene and that you had a gun and that you arrived there late at night and that you were at the exact location? Okay, that leads because the answer is suggested in the question. There is all this evidence, you know, we say, there are all of these surveys that show that leading questions lead to more admissions. And so, but the point of it is to ask leading questions on cross-examination and go for the details, meticulously go for the details, because witnesses frequently do not think through all the details. So on cross-examination, when you start asking them particular facts about when, what, where, how long, and we're going to go through that a little later, they will, you can catch them in a little trap, shall we say. They'll choke because they haven't worked out the details. Like I said earlier, to some degree, never show that a witness's testimony hurts your case. We already talked about watching the body language and watching it at all times. We're going to talk about, during closing arguments, about telling the jurors about your burden of proof. If you're the prosecutor, you want to show that the burden of proof is not that high. Ladies and gentlemen, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not proof beyond all doubt. It's not proof beyond every doubt. It's not proof beyond any doubt. It is simply proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You want to go through that? If you're the defense lawyer, you're going to make it the highest burden of proof. It, ladies and gentlemen, there's preponderance of evidence, and that's one standard, and there's clear and convincing evidence, and that's another standard. But the highest standard of all is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I am always shocked when I see lawyers who do not define or do not give arguments on the proof that they, their burden of proof that they must meet. Sorry. You absolutely need to define the burden of proof in a light that is most favorable to you. Now, this is very important, the next point. Tell jurors what to do. Tell them. Because if you don't tell them, they'll be left wondering what to do. And by that, I mean you tell them, ladies and gentlemen, if you believe the witness, you should find the defendant not guilty. If you believe this witness, find him not guilty. You're telling them what to do. If you leave it up to them, and then tell them, this witness told the truth based on the circumstantial evidence and all of the evidence. It is clear the circumstantial evidence backs his testimony and that he told the truth. All right, but you're telling them what to do rather than leaving it up to them. As we talked earlier about controlling the courtroom, and I told you earlier about how logical arguments control the case. Logical arguments are the most persuasive is the most persuasive evidence in any case. You're going to argue to the jury that they must accept or that they should accept the reasonable interpretation of the evidence and reject the unreasonable interpretation of the evidence. There's actually a jury instruction on this, and it's pretty much, I'm pretty sure, universal throughout all states throughout the country. And so you're going to be appealing to their common sense. Ladies and gentlemen, you should use common sense. And you should not accept some unreasonable interpretation of the evidence. Actually, in voir dire, you're going to have given them some hypotheticals about things that were totally unreasonable that somebody might have believed. And you're going to show them how and tell them in closing about that hypothetical. You're going to reconnect it and say that the judge is going to tell you that you should not believe an unreasonable interpretation of the evidence. And then you're going to tell them the testimony or the evidence that was unreasonable and tell them why they should not believe that. And then you're going to tell them the testimony or the evidence that was reasonable that supports your case and why they should believe that. And absolutely, you're going to tell them that they should not trust a witness who deliberately lied. You're going to tell them that. You need to straight out tell them that. I know sometimes lawyers feel like, oh, I don't want to call a witness a liar. There's nothing wrong with that. If it is clear that a witness lied, you can argue that the witness did not tell the truth, and therefore you should disregard their testimony and not find in their favor. Tell the jurors what are the important facts. Don't leave it up to them to guess. If you leave it up to them to guess, they may not get it right. So tell them this, ladies and gentlemen, you're telling them this during closing argument, is an important fact. It is a profound piece of evidence in this particular case. And tell them what it is and lay it all out. Point out inconsistencies in your opponent's case. Make logical, coherent, persuasive arguments. Make passionate arguments. Never make unreasonable or ridiculous arguments. Produce all of the physical evidence. Always produce all of the physical evidence. I'm going to have to start going really fast now. The physical evidence, ladies and gentlemen, you will argue does not lie. That blood on the gun, or that DNA on the weapon, those fingerprints, those pictures of the victim at the defendant's house. You're going to argue physical. People may lie, ladies and gentlemen, but the physical evidence does not lie, and the physical evidence is supported by the testimony given by our witnesses. So that's one of the canned arguments you're going to make in virtually every case. You're going to emphasize the expertise, especially if you have expert testimony, the expertise of your witness. Build him up high, high, high as one of the greatest experts in the area. Through your direct examination, ask him questions about his knowledge, training, and experience. And also present your witnesses, portray them as best as possible, as honest and having the highest integrity. Make all appropriate arguments, all appropriate arguments. And I mentioned earlier, let me just reiterate, make all appropriate charges. Don't leave out appropriate charges. Do not overcharge if you're a prosecutor, but don't leave out appropriate charges. Create a checklist of all important arguments and all important charges. Know the rules of evidence. Know the rules of evidence. We talked about that earlier. Be professional. Be professionally dressed. Use plain English. Do not talk over your jurors' heads. Do not use big words that they don't understand, because that is useless for you. Do not release a rebuttal witness before you're done with the trial. I've seen it happen several times. They release the witness who they had on direct examination, and then it turns out testimony comes in, and they need that witness back, and they cannot find the witness or can't get them back in. Do not release him. Look smart and confident at all times. Tell the jurors to decide the case based on logic, based on common sense, and not to decide the case based on who they liked or just some kind of whimsical analysis. Tell them to follow the evidence. Use, as I've indicated earlier, all the evidence that damages your opponent's case. Admission, we talked about O.J. Simpson, and flight, and always, jurors want to hear about motive. Tell them the motive during your closing argument as to why certain things happen. Show and argue motive in every case if possible. I've already said to argue the standard of proof, but in your particular case, and we'll run out of time, so I'm going to have to do this real fast. You're going to create a chart. And like I said earlier, you're going to, on the one chart, on one side, you're going to have the elements, and you're going to, that you must prove. And on the other side, you're going to have the facts that prove.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is pizza. P-I-Z-Z-A. Pizza. Esquire CLE's second verification code is pizza. P-I-Z-Z-A. Pizza. Please take a moment and write this down.
That element. But you're also going to always say in your closing argument, you're going to cite the standard of proof and say how you met it. So that means you're going to say, ladies and gentlemen, there is no reasonable doubt in this case because there was blood found on the knife, because there was the defendant was at the scene, and because the witnesses testified that they saw him there with the knife and the blood DNA matches his DNA. Alternatively, you're going to argue, ladies and gentlemen, the prosecution has not met their burden of proof because there was no blood. The witnesses said the defendant wasn't even there, and on and on and on. The important point is to create a checklist and to create big charts. Now, your charts can either be handwritten or in the modern day, well, I'm back in the Stone Age, but in the modern day, you have computer screens and projection screens. You need to present all of the arguments, but going back, you need to present all of the physical evidence and portray it. And that would mean, and jurors are impressed by this, that would mean, pictures of the victim's injuries or pictures of the defendant or pictures of the weapon. Have them bring the knife, the gun into court, and if the witnesses bring it into court, or whatever the evidence may be, pictures of cars, pictures of people, videos, whatever the evidence may be, and you're going to get it into evidence, and then you're going to present it again during your closing argument. You're going to have during your closing argument a big blown up picture of the victim's injuries, or a big blown up picture of that the defendant had mutual injuries, or a big blown up picture of the accident, of the damage to the vehicles. And so you want to present all of your scientific evidence. The jurors expect this. They expect you to present all of the scientific evidence that you have before you and to connect it up with whatever you have, timelines, time lapse, and to show all of this evidence and to present it, especially, again, during closing argument, if it is persuasive to your case. Now, on one of your charts, the blow-up charts, you're going to have all these blow-up charts that you're going to present during closing argument. And on one of these charts, you're going to have basically all of your irrefutable arguments, your most powerful arguments. It must be, even if it's a computer-generated, even if it's on the screen, make the letters and words large enough for the jurors to read. I cannot tell you how many times I've had lawyers who have that screen up there and they show it, and the jurors, the print is so small they can't read half the words. Big, bold letters, big, bold sentences, big PowerPoint lines of what are your most powerful arguments in the case. You keep that in front of them for a while so that they can see it and focus on your side of the case. You want them focusing on the strengths and of your case and not focused on your weaknesses. So, once again, pure logic wins cases. Pure logic is the most powerful persuader. Motivation, urgency, and sincerity, fighting hard, makes a difference between a winner and a loser. Closing arguments, use your most powerful closing
argument. Use your most powerful closing arguments at the very end of your case. I need to go back quickly to your jury instructions. At some point, you will meet with the judge, and you'll try to get in. You must be prepared to argue to get in your most favorable jury instructions. Some of them will be obvious, but from the defense or from the prosecution or from the civil, get in the most favorable jury instructions that favor your case. I'm always shocked when I speak to a lawyer and I say, well, did you get in the jury instruction that says the testimony of one witness alone may serve as the basis for your case? And frequently they say no. And you want to be able to argue that, because so often when we be exiting, the jurors be exiting, and you talk to them and they say, well, you know, we didn't believe this witness and we didn't believe these other two witnesses, but we really believe this one witness. Oh, we thought she was just so honest. And that's why we decided the case. And you want to be able to argue, ladies and gentlemen, the judge is going to read you an instruction that says the testimony of one witness alone may serve as the basis of your case. You want to read that and argue that and then argue this witness, you know, was credible based on the evidence. It's clear that this witness told you the truth. We're going to keep moving right along. Now, for this part of the program, I'm going to go through this really fast because I think we're running out of time. What we're going to do is go through every part of a trial, and I created what I call a tickler chart. And a tickler chart is just something to stimulate your mind so that you start to think about exactly what areas you need to address. So let's start off with voir dire. You're always going to talk about reasonable doubt during voir dire. You're going to tell them that the judge is going to, at some point, read them a statement with regard to reasonable doubt, the law, and ask them whether they can follow that with regard to reasonable doubt. You're going to ask them their feelings regarding police officers and or any other area that your witnesses are engaged in. Like if you have experts, you're going to ask them what they think about medical experts. Do they have any feelings about them? You're going to get them to talk about common sense and determining credibility. How do they determine whether a person is telling the truth or not? You're going to talk to them about asking them whether they can give a fair trial to both sides. You're going to tell them about sympathy. The judge is going to tell them not to consider sympathy, and you're going to ask them whether they can follow the judge's instruction not to consider sympathy. If you're a prosecutor or if you're the defense lawyer, you may have a different approach. You're going to talk to them about accepting, as we said earlier, the reasonable interpretation of the evidence and rejecting the unreasonable interpretation of the evidence. You're going to talk to them and ask them about what magazines they like, what friends they have, about how they judge motive, how they judge character, whether they think law should be softer or tougher, what they think about the standard I said earlier of reasonable doubt. You're going to go through those hypothetical questions with them, and you're going to get them to talking. About what they feel about things, how they feel about law enforcement, or how they feel about accident reconstruction experts, and how they feel about doctors. And so do they think doctors can be honest? Do they think police officers can be honest? What do they think that the law is fair? You're going to go through this, all of this, and you're going to be watching them, analyzing them to figure out exactly what approach, whether you should keep them or kick them. Obviously, you cannot kick any juror on the basis of discrimination. You might get a Wheeler motion. I don't want to go into, I don't have time to go into detail of that, but be aware of it. But if your instincts say that you should kick a person, based on their body language, based on their answers, then by all means do so, but be prepared to explain it to the judge if it appears as though there might be some suspect reason for kicking a juror during your peremptory challenges. Now, let's quickly go to areas for direct examination. I'm going to whiz through these so fast, you won't believe it. But you're going to be able to play this tape back, and then you'll be able to take your time and go through each one of these various factors in preparing your questions for direct examination. These are just ticklers. So here we go. Who, what, when, where, how, why, see, smell, say, do. What did he do? Where did he go? What did he see? What did he smell? Locations, times, places, events, things, descriptions, injuries, emotions, motivations, expertise, knowledge, prior experience, objects, obstructions, conditions, weather, memory, persons, descriptions, distances, places, inconsistencies, consistencies, admissions. How did he hear? How did he feel, I should say? What did he hear? Touch. Irregularities. How long? How short? How much? How close? How big? How many? Recognition. Past memories. Names. Dates. Places. Existence or non-existence. Fingerprints. Competing sounds. Prior activities. Positions of parties. Distractions. Lightings. Okay, this is just a few of the areas that you're going to go into for, with regard to a direct examination. With regard to cross-examination, it's very almost the same, pretty much similar stuff. You're going to go into observations. What did they see, feel, hear, identification, identifying people, actions, where did they go, what did they say, knowledge of who, when, what, how, why, physical objects, items, things that were there, memory with regard to details, motivations, bias, expertise, experience, atmosphere, conditions, emotional state, excited, calm, time sequences, locations, persons, things, inconsistencies, events, chronologies, environments, buildings, streets, lights, trees, sidewalks, distances, proximities, testimony, prior testimony, on and on and on. Those are just a few areas for cross-examination. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm going to whiz through closing arguments. And we've already talked about some of the canned closing arguments, but here are just a few more, because I got so many, but I just don't have the time. Here we go. Explain the seriousness of the crime. Always explain the seriousness of the crime. Obviously, you got to get it into direct examination in order to get it into evidence, I should say, in order to be able to explain it. You got to have a witness testify as to the crime and why it's serious and things like that. Always, like I said earlier, explain your standard of proof, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or a preponderance of evidence, whatever it is, always explain. Always explain the charges, too. Explain the charges. Create an element charge. Always have it available. Tell them why. Like I said earlier, always tell them why there is no reasonable doubt or there is reasonable doubt, or tell them specifically how you met your burden of proof in closing argument. Like I said earlier, use pictures and documents and all types of evidence, physical evidence, and if it's already been admitted in the evidence, you can show the pictures, show the documents, show the weapon to the jurors during your closing argument, and you will want to do that. Jurors always argue that they should disregard unreasonable testimony. We talked about that. And tell them that all of the elements are present for the entire case. Tell them exactly how each element is present. Talk to them about the experience and training of your witnesses, how they have superior training and knowledge and skill and education. Talk to them about motive, the motive for certain things, for certain actions. Talk to them, defendant raised, you can say, not the defendant, but the alternative, I'm sorry, your opponent raised irrelevant issues. Wow, I think I'm just about out of time, so I'm going to race through this even faster. I know you get tired of me saying that, but look at the totality of the evidence as you're going to argue to them. Talk to them about witnesses who told the truth. Talk to them about any admissions. Talk to them about common sense. Common sense. Over and over again, mention that. Talk to them about absolute certainty is not necessary. depending on which side you're on, and tell them what to do. If you believe the defendant committed the act, you should find him guilty, ladies and gentlemen. If you believe he committed a crime, I'm out of time, ladies and gentlemen. But I do want to thank you for the time you've given me. I know I've been excited, and I've raced through a lot of materials, but I can tell you that if you follow the principles that I've laid out in this tape, you will be successful. You will be a winning lawyer. You will get into the zone, and you will feel you will not feel the agony of defeat, but you will feel the thrill of victory. So thank you very much. Once again, my name is Bernie Brown. Have a wonderful day. Go now and win trials. Bye now.